Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hello and welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast with me, Joanne O'Riordan, and Cork's Red FM. This episode is part two of our interview with Maura Trasny-Callig, where we talk to her about 20 by 20, the implications that has, and what it's like to be a woman in sport today. I suppose I was going to ask you a little bit as well about 20 by 20, because it's a huge thing at the moment. I read that you said that, you know, it could be a little bit tokenistic, but it's necessary. Yeah. And I kind of feel the same thing. Like, it is a little bit like, we should give this woman a job just because she's a woman, but I'm part of me like, is just give it because she deserves it, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely that aspect to it, but... I think possibly what happened, a bit like the local elections, when people were saying, you know, we should have quotas for females, people were saying, oh, she's good enough, she'll get onto the ticket. But we've seen time and time again, that's not the case.
No.
So sometimes we do have to positively discriminate to get people to a position that they can compete. So therefore, I don't think it's as simple as give a woman a job, but I think it's inviting women to interviews and to allow them to compete, for example, so that if there was a job going here, for example, that you're told there's a job, that I'm told there's a job, that they're advertising it as well, but they're saying really they're making it female friendly.
It's like kind of like the Rooney rule in the NFL.
Yeah.
You have to interview someone that's...
Yeah.
Just in case, like they could be good.
Yeah,
you never know.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They might be good. And it's not just women. I think we're seeing it in all minorities. And women aren't even minority. We're 51% of the population.
Yeah.
We are the majority minority. And yet for some reason, everything pertaining to women, from like cervical smears to things to do with maternity care to jobs to security, women always end up worse off. And why is that? Because men tend to legislate, and they're not doing it on purpose. They just don't understand.
Yeah.
So the whole thing, the whole 20 by 20 thing, is it tokenistic? Yeah. Was it badly needed? Yes. Did we need to have conversations? Yes. Do most people agree with it and say, yes, it should be done? Absolutely. Is there one or two whiners? Absolutely. Who are they? Male, pale, straight men who really are worried about their status quo, because you know why? They probably weren't that good at it to begin with. And now they're worried that there's more people coming in to compete. So I always think, like, if you're keeping people down or worried that some people are getting notional about themselves, you need to have a good hard look about yourself. And that's nothing to do with women. That's just life. But I think the 20 by 20 thing is definitely... It's forced media organisations to publish more.
Mm-hmm.
It's forced us to broadcast more. It's forced us to give women more time. And it's brought things about, like, okay, I know the Women's World Cup was booked and paid for last year before 20 by 20 even became a thing, but still got people talking about it. And now we're seeing great footballers on the telly every night. And guess what? The only people you say complaining about it are faceless trolls on the Twitter machine.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else just appreciates it's just good football on TV when there's no other football on. Let's watch it.
Yeah. I was laughing because at one stage I felt I was seeing more Japanese ladies than like GA, and I was like,
yeah,
my world is turning completely upside down. But it's interesting because even my dad, like, he never would have asked me anything about like ladies sports. He like would have never asked me about ladies football or women in sport or whatever, and now he comes in every day and he's like, oh, who are the USA playing?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very good,
because it's just put there for people on free to air TV.
Yeah.
And that just goes to show it was never about women's sport is worse, it's just it wasn't available. So you know what, that comes back to media.
Yeah. Do you think we're more responsible for women in sport? So you think and I think it's primarily up to us.
Yeah.
But you think we're one of the main heavy hitters that needs to be?
We absolutely do. We have to create the product to make people interested, because it goes back to what we were saying earlier. You need to know who you're watching. You need to know their story, and that will bring people along bit by bit. Because the danger now is we see the huge crowds at the ladies football final every year, but who goes to league games? Who goes? And part of the problem there is the product. Like, for example, I remember last summer being at the Gaelic grounds watching Cork clatter,
I think it was Meath. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nobody wants to watch that. I mean, even Cork people, if they would be bored off their tree watching that.
Yeah.
So that's where it's up to the various organisations to ensure that coaching standards are improving constantly, that there's targets laid out for teams, that Westmeath will be competitive in a few years' time, that other teams will be competitive, that there's a product to watch. Because one thing about Ireland is, as you said, the Japanese ladies, we'll watch anything so long as it's entertaining.
Yeah.
And that's not to men or women. And this is why, for example, I think the crowds are falling off for Dublin matches when they're playing minnows. It's not the Dub's fault, but who wants to watch that?
Yeah, no way.
The only time, I think, as a Dub fan, if I was a Dub fan, the only time I might ever go to Dublin playing, I mean, no disrespect to Wicklow or anything like that, but are loud. The only time I'm going to go with that is if I happen to be a real grown up with children and I'm thinking this might be an opportunity to get a photo with a Dub afterwards.
Yeah.
That's not a good reason to go to a game.
No, it's a bit tragic because then you're showing that to your children and they're like, well, why should I be interested in this?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, so you need to give people something to enjoy. You want to go to a game that you don't know the result of, or that something might happen.
Do you think, because I was even, a few ladies footballers were saying it to me, that they now feel that it's gone like so far that they feel ready to take, not criticism, but like little pieces in the paper going, you know, Cork's midfield is non-existent, therefore, you know, they were even saying that it shouldn't be glossed over anymore.
Absolutely not. That used to drive me nuts. It was all, oh, sure, look, aren't they great for trying?
The patronising thing,
I hate that. I want people to pull teams apart the way we do men teams. Mm-hmm. I want, constructively, not to be critical, but constructive criticism to say, where was their half-back line? Why she was half asleep? Why didn't that happen? You know, if you're out playing top-level sport, you deserve that.
Yeah.
And you deserve to be critiqued that way, and you deserve to be praised when praise is deserved. But you cannot just be looking at them and shaking their hands and say, aren't they great? Yeah. God love them. Wasn't she wonderful for trying?
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you're going to make women's sport appealing, you're going to have to create a bit of fire in their bellies, a bit of competitiveness, and make kids aspire to that as well, I think.
I suppose like the first thing now that I'm thinking of is the US and the Thai team, the 13-0. Do you think that we were a bit more nice to the Thai? Like if that was the Thai men's team, would we be like, they're useless? They should never play football again.
Because
okay, maybe not Thailand, but
That was the USA, so they're a league of their own, you know.
It's like Spain and Tahiti. I remember
what was the score on that one again?
It was 10-0 in the Confederations, And I remember we were a bit patronising to Tahiti going, I'm sure they're a rowing country.
Yeah. Well, yeah, see, there is that, but I suppose when it's difficult. When you're playing something like the USA and they're miles ahead of all their competitors, bar one or two. And that's where you don't want to be beating up a team who had lost before they'd even started.
Yeah.
And were coming from such a low level. I'd be questioning what was Thailand doing at the World Cup.
Because that Thai coach basically came out and said, we're nobody's punchbag. We beat Australia.
Yeah.
And they're tipped to win the World Cup.
Yeah.
But then they just
disintegrated.
Yeah.
And sometimes teams just do that. But, you know, it's a big thing about World Cups in general, isn't it? That if you're a European country, it's harder to qualify, and then you see other lower quality teams from other parts of the world getting in, and that's where you'd be watching and thinking, geez, Ireland did so well at the start of their World Cup campaign, you know, the Netherlands and stuff, that if things had been different, Ireland might have been there. And you're thinking, would the USA have beaten Ireland in the World Cup? Probably. Would it be 13-0? No,
definitely wouldn't. And I think that's where everyone got a little bit more frustrated, because I remember my brother rang me and he was like, why aren't Ireland in this World Cup?
Yeah.
And I was like, well,
did you go to Tala Stadium to their matches?
But I was also like, well, it's also Europe. Like, you know, we're playing against pro teams.
Yeah.
Like the England's, the Germany's, England, Italy's.
The Netherlands, Sweden, teams who actually have budgets and wages and money and proper time together. Like, that is the big challenge Colin Bell has here. He's trying to get his team together without near the amount of support structures that other teams have. Mm. So they're doing really well to get where they are. And the fact that we have like Katie McCabe and Louise Quinn with Arsenal and stuff, it shows the calibre we have here, if just we had a pathway to develop it.
Yeah. They're still kind of struggling, but then more girls are joining in.
Mm.
And I think the drop-off rate, like, you obviously know all about the drop-off rate. Like, what's your, like, what would you say would be the thing that we need to keep girls on? Like, what would the main thing be?
They need to keep seeing people like Louise Quinn out and about. I think that does a huge thing. I couldn't imagine as a child rocking up to Croke Park and seeing, you know, where the railway bridge is.
Yes.
And a few years ago, Lidl put up branding. They put up Cora Staunton, Sarah Rowe, Sinead Goldrick, big photos of women looking like they played sport. And never in my life have I seen that. Like, growing up, the only female athlete I saw on telly was Sonia O'Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I was never going to run like Sonia for a start, but I mean, that just wasn't attainable for most of us.
Yeah.
Whereas playing for your county team, you could argue it's a dream that's not absolutely unlikely for people.
Yeah.
Do you know, and girls were never given that option to dream. They have that now, so they need to keep seeing it. And that's where 20 by 20 is good, because it's put people like Louise Quinn out into people's faces, and you suddenly realise, this is a strong woman. Look at what she's doing over in Arsenal. She's travelled all over Europe. She's travelled the States playing football. She's still playing football. Look at the skill she has. Like, I played in a media game with them a few weeks ago.
Yeah. And I heard you were diving.
I fell over myself, not even diving. I was like, I had a clear run at goal and I started running, but unfortunately the top of my body went faster than the bottom part, and I just did a complete somersault over myself. And I had people laughing at me. It wasn't very kind. But at one point, like in the second half,
did you throw a tantrum? My sporting career is done.
I couldn't even throw a tantrum. I was so winded myself. But like in the second half, I grew a bit of confidence and that kind of stuff. And I was playing away, and I stupidly brought the ball into a tackle against Katie McCabe, and I fell over backwards onto my bum. And you're thinking, like, these women are so strong, and we don't appreciate on telly till you're out there and you actually see the skill they have, the touch they have, the taps. It's amazing. And we just never saw that until very recently. So I think if 20 by 20 has to be applauded for, it's for that we're seeing people like these now all the time.
Where do you think it goes then after that? Like, what do you think? Like, do you think it's legislation? Do you think it's, like, do you think it's we need more people, say, on boards, like more women on boards? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, it's top down and bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
until we have more women in power, and I mean that as in government, more women on boards, more women in charge of county boards, so if we're going to use the Gaelic Games example, more women in charge of, or at the very least, very involved. And then that they're also trained to coach, because at the moment it's very difficult to find female coaches, for example. Yep. They still stick out like a sore thumb, like female journalists. And that until the Department of Education comes on board and makes physical activity, not being good at sport, there's a big difference.
Yeah.
But making physical activity mandatory for everyone in a way that to find sport that's fun for everyone. Everyone has something we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of us. There's something all of us can do. We just have to find it. I saw there were huge discussions last week about some school had a sports day where there was no prizes given out.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw some people giving out about this, oh, children need to learn about competition. And I'm thinking, there's plenty of competition out there. If you want to bring your child to competition, you can bring them and join sports teams in school, outside of school. But sports day can really cause damage to kids who can't participate fully for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
or just aren't that good, or just don't have, like, are clumsy, or just can't run that fast, or might be a bit overweight or stuff like that. Like, ideally, you want the child who's carrying a bit of extra weight to enjoy sports day,
yeah.
and enjoy playing and go out again over the summer. That's the ideal scenario coming out of sports day, not winning trophies.
Yeah.
You know, and I think once all those things come together, as a society, we'll be healthier. Our minds will be healthier. Our bodies certainly will be healthier. Like, the top four diseases in this country, a lot of them are caused by inactivity and obesity.
Mm.
So if we were to do that, we'd be going really, really well. And then when you're feeling a bit better about yourself, you're more inclined to participate in things. And this is why men have five-a-side football teams and women don't,
yeah.
really. I think that's changing, and it's too late for our generation, but the ones coming after us, I think it's our obligation that if we ever have kids, or we're reminding people or reminding ourselves, that we have to go out and keep moving, and we all have something we can move.
Yeah, it's true.
You know?
I'm just getting flashbacks to when I had sports day and I came last, they gave me a participation medal and I threw it away. It was that level of competitive.
Wow.
Yeah, my mother was like, geez.
You came last even though you had electronics underneath you.
Yeah, it was really embarrassing. I literally threw the medal away. I was like, this is the most humiliating thing I've ever gone through my whole entire life. But my mother was like, oh, I'm very proud. And I was like, I've never been so ashamed of myself my whole entire life. But yeah, it was just because I was that level of competitive. And I remember her basically, that was when she decided to put me into like singular competitions.
Yeah.
So she put me to swimming because she knew I couldn't give out to myself there, or if I did, I'd drown.
Yeah. Exactly. And you were able to compete against yourself in swimming, and you had your own targets and you were able to do it. But that's what I mean. People might say, oh, look at Joanne, what sport can she do? And actually, you can swim.
Yep.
And just people just wouldn't think of that.
I'm the only one in my family who can swim.
Really?
Yeah. None of them. They're all afraid of water.
Wow.
I was like born. My mother was like, oh, okay. If there's one thing she can do, it should be to swim, because the water is very, you know, soothing for people. And then I just got really competitive and I decided to swim.
Yeah, there you go. Like, everyone has something, but we need to be encouraged to find it. And I think the experiences of sports days are, you know, really drives me mad. And I've spoken to kids and they're so hurt by it. The under 10 team who won't play the kid because he's not good enough.
It's really sad.
God. Like, it should be about fun. I question the coaches who do that kind of thing.
Was that under 12 game and that happened?
Yeah.
They were winning by like 20 points.
The
other team had like ran out their whole bench or whatever, and then the other fellow was like, no. And they were all standing in the freezing cold.
Yeah.
I was like, dude.
It's not doing anyone any good. And then the people wonder why we have drop-off rates of 50% by the time kids are 13, 14. This is why.
Yeah.
Like, who is sport for? What is sport for? It's meant to be for all of us. And stuff like that really enrages me. It really, really makes me angry. Because it just goes against all research, goes against all common sense. And then, like, I would be off maybe sometimes working with little camogie teams and stuff like that. Like, a lot of the time people bring us in to talk to girls, you know, yourself, girls of a certain age, and you taught them about well-being and looking after themselves and that kind of stuff. And they like bringing somebody like me in who doesn't have any skin in their game. And I can tell them, you know, talk to them about, you know, we're all growing up, we're changing, we're going to look a bit different and need to keep playing sport, and just hammering that home and reminding them that sport is fun. And sometimes they forget that, and that's really sad. And then we get the parents and the coaches to leave the room. And
I was just about to say, do you think it's parents as well?
A lot of the time.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. It's very easy for us to sit here and talk about parents since we're not parents.
I know.
You know, they're saying, oh, yeah, wait, you have your own.
My little shih tzu is doing just fine, thank you.
Exactly. Well, I don't even have the shih tzu to mind. There you go. But like, they often say, I just wish they'd stop yelling at me, or stop yelling at the coach or complaining, or I wish the coach stopped yelling. So I know people go into coaching and stuff like that because they really mean really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's not their fault they don't have the guidance. This is what I mean, top down. If we had more of that, I think we'd all be better off.
Yeah. That's really interesting, though. Like, it's like the psychology and everything coming out in one medicine.
Yeah.
That's why you're doing all these degrees.
So I'm doing all these degrees to be utterly overqualified and never get a job. And not a real job anyway, just traveling around the country with my microphone antagonizing managers.
You just started in your hospital wards, haven't you?
Yes.
How's that going for you?
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's very, very interesting. We started off in
Is it different to the journalism, like in the scrum with all the men doing an interview? Like, or have you learned skills from that?
Oh, I definitely took skills. Like, the big thing about being a doctor is talking to somebody and finding out what's wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the first thing you do when you go into your GP, they ask you why you're here today. And then you're trying to find out who, what, where, when, why. That's an automatic skill I've already brought with me. And I'm used to asking people questions they might be comfortable with. Because, you know, sometimes healthcare involves talking about things like waterworks, bowel movements, mm-hmm. things working, things not working. And not everybody's comfortable talking about that, but you need to elicit that kind of information out of people, or you can end up giving them the wrong medication, for example, or not really get to the crux of the problem. Or a lot of the time they come in, apparently, I mean, I'm not at that stage yet, but apparently people come in and they'll dance around it and then they're walking out to surgery, and just they're walking out, then they say, oh yeah, there's this one thing, and then it turns out that was the real problem.
Yeah.
So to be able to understand that and think maybe there's something going on like that, that was a big help. The not having any science was a huge hindrance.
This is a heart. Yeah, I don't know anything after that.
It was a bit like that. Yeah, this is a heart. Okay. Where's the aorta? I'm like,
you know, throwing a dart at it.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of that. Like, jeepers, the anatomy practicals, they were a baptism of fire for me. Because everything was brand new to me. Most people in the class, they were physios, they'd done degrees in science, they'd done molecular, they've been working in labs already. So even they say, oh, it didn't really help me. It did. Because for a start, they weren't Googling words lecturers were saying.
Yeah.
So everything was brand new. So it was very, very hard, enjoyable hard. But then when you began on the wards, it all kind of began to kind of knit in together. So I did 2 weeks working in nephrology, which is dealing with kidneys and stuff like that, and various issues people might have with kidney failure, and did 2 weeks in surgery, which was interesting.
That's fascinating.
It is really fascinating to see how they do it now. Like, when you consider operations that just couldn't be done years ago, or would leave people with like a top to bottom scar, and it's all done by keyhole now, and you're watching it and you're getting really into it, until of course a surgeon asks you, what's this?
There's someone lying on the table.
Yeah, and you're just watching along and you're learning so much as this is happening, and you're just thinking, this is a miracle. But it's not a miracle, it's science.
Yeah.
But it's just amazing.
It's still miraculous though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like when I had my first back surgery, it was, as you were saying, the top to bottom scar.
Yeah.
And I was never like self-conscious about it. Like, it didn't bother me. But then when I was getting older and older, I was like, oh no, you know, body, you know, and things like that. And I had to go for another back operation. And my surgeon was like, looking, and he was like, whoever did that, he doesn't know what he's doing. And I remember he just did some cosmetic stuff, and he's supposed to be just a random orthopedic surgeon. But it was just mad for me how like it had changed.
Yeah.
And I was mortified to tell him, oh, like, aesthetics is huge. And he was like, oh, I get it. You're a girl.
Yeah. You know? Aesthetics is huge for all of us.
Yeah.
Like, why would, again, back in the day, there mightn't have been any other option but to do the top to bottom scar.
Yeah.
But if you can avoid it, why wouldn't you?
I was mind blown, and he gave me the stitches for the knee, for like random knee surgery, because apparently my back was the length of an average knee, which made me laugh uncontrollably.
Really?
Yeah. So he like stitched it, you know, the suture bead.
Yeah, yeah.
So he stitched it inside, and that's why I have less of a scar. But I remember years ago, that was just staples. You know, I'm just hoping for the best.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Like, and it's just mad how there was people getting surgery, and very heavy duty surgery, and then the next day they're up in the high dependency unit and they're sitting out of the bed and they're being made walk around by physios just to get everything moving again, and they're feeling, I won't say they're feeling good, they're not on top of the world, but they're feeling a lot better than you would expect compared to what their bodies would have gone through years ago previously. And when you think about it, even 10 years ago, some of the surgeries I saw possibly just wouldn't even be possible.
Yeah.
You'd be sent home and be told, you know, this is all we can do for you, you know, apologies, but off you go. It just goes to show the advancements. It's mind blowing, really. Like,
even like DA surgeries, like people just getting up after like a big massive operation, you're like, oh,
yeah,
fair enough, bye.
Yeah, it's mad. It's absolutely mind blowing. Like, so I came out of Beaumont Hospital every day thinking, wow. And I'd go home and I'd have like my little notebook and I have stuff to Google that night and read up about, because so much is happening.
Yeah.
And you can't be, when a surgeon's in the middle of doing something, you can't be peering in like a little squirrel going, oh, what's that now? Like, why are you doing that? And what drug is that? Like, so you just have to keep an eye on things, watch it, and just kind of write things down, because there's only so much you can ask them when they're in the middle of the flow, you know. And then, and dangerously, then whenever they had a bit of downtime, they were asking you questions, which you didn't want either, because then you're exposing yourself to how stupid you actually were. And I'd like to tell everyone who's listening to this, I will not be doing any surgery alone for a hell of a long time.
I was just going to ask,
if ever.
Are you going to do a surgery?
No.
No.
No, I like life too much.
Really?
They have to do the amount of hours they have to do to get to that level.
True.
They have to be so dedicated to it. And a bit like talking about women earlier, this is the reason why most surgeons are men. They have more time for it. I think women have to choose between ovaries or surgery.
That's true.
The hours they have to do and stuff. It's not female friendly. It's not family friendly.
No.
I don't see that changing anytime soon. It should. A bit like the army, like when they do 6 month tours of duty, if they did 2 or 3 months, I think we'd have more women doing them.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I mean about life needing to change to suit the majority of the country, not the minority.
Yeah.
And all the surgeons I've seen so far, they've been so dedicated to it. And you know they've put hours of training in. So you're absolutely safe, people, to go under the knife. These people know what they're doing. But if you see me coming at you, just run away. You're obviously at the wrong hospital. I've obviously gone deranged. I found a scalpel somewhere. Just don't.
I literally loved my back surgeon to bits. And I remember the first day I met him, I realised he had a twitch. And I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? But obviously he didn't like steady concentration. You know, he was a different person than under, like with the mask on. And I was like, oh my God, it's so bizarre. Like, but he was such a nice guy. He was like 6'10". I thought he was a basketballer. I thought he was French because his name was Jacques. Turned out my GP actually went to school with his dad. So that shows generational stuff there. I was like just absolutely mind blown. But it's mad how people change though once they go in to war. Do you find that you're, you're mentally changing and then you come out, you're exhausted because you're not you?
Yeah. I'm absolutely exhausted, but I think I'm exhausted from learning.
Okay.
There's so much that I learn and take in every day that by the time I come out, my mind is drained in a good way. But definitely, yeah, I think you do have to take on a bit of a soothing persona.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be as mad as I might be outside. And I think especially because I don't know enough. But sometimes, because I'm that little bit older, you often see, you know, patients or patients' families will look at me and they'll look at the intern with me or the doctor and they'll assume that I must be the boss. And they're like, no, I'm the one learning. I don't know where your aorta is. You need to talk to this person.
You should really learn where the aorta is.
I will at some point. It'll sink in at some point, possibly when I have the scalpel there. But
whoever is getting her is open heart surgery.
Yeah, if you ever see me in cardiology, run.
In general, like what do you expect? Like, what do you want from like the future? Like, what, obviously you want to be a doctor. Is there any specific type of thing you want to be?
I have this idea, and it might sound very Rose of Tralee, but my idea is I'd like to be a GP. I would like to qualify as a GP someday, but to bring the psychology along with it. So, for example, if you're coming to me and you happen to be a type 2 diabetic, that, yes, by all means, we will give you all the drugs you need and all that kind of stuff, but we'll also create a well-being and psychology and exercise plan for you. Because sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes if you manage your type 2 diabetes well, you can actually come off medication altogether and start, I won't say reversing, but stop the thing progressing. As one example, a lot of the problems people have, like people come in with pains in their stomach and you're giving them stuff for their stomach, but then you realise it's from stress and anxiety. So you could help them manage that. So I like the idea of maybe having my own GP surgery someday, but also maybe running classes and anxiety management, stress management, getting people out and about, you know, forcing people to exercise. Because a lot of the time, I don't know anybody who doesn't feel better after exercise. It's just, it can be a bit of a trauma to get yourself up off the couch to do it.
Yeah.
So prescribing exercise, giving them, creating the data that we know X amount of exercise will help you. You must hit this target. That kind of stuff. Because if I gave you a pill and said, this is going to make you feel better, help you lose weight, you'll sleep better at night, you'll have a better appetite, and you'll have all around, you'll look better. You'd take it and you'd pay a fortune for it. But for some reason, when it's exercise, people don't do it. So I'd love to be that kind of person who kind of be a conduit there, or maybe work in the field of public health and policy, or maybe marrying them both. I don't see me in a hospital. People be glad to hear, since I don't know where an aorta is. But I like the idea of being out in the community, trying in my own very small way of affecting change. And that's why I say, I know this sounds like a Rose of Tralee answer because it sounds so unrealistic, but if we don't plan, we'll never get to it.
But I think it could be though, because I think it is changing. Like, I think there is a generational shift in that one. Like, you know, like, I think when I go into a doctor, I'm more like, how will I prevent this? You know, because I don't, like, it's not that I don't want to come back, but I'm like, I don't want to come back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like, exactly. And so many of our big illnesses are preventative, or at the very least, some people are really unlucky. You can do all the right things and still get cancer, or do all the right things and still die of a heart attack. But in general, that doesn't happen. Those people are outliers, you know, so... Like, you'd see people sometimes who are suffering really, really, really horrible consequences and complications from things like diabetes. Like, people lose their feet, they lose limbs, they lose their sight. Like, that's not a nice way to be. The kidney's going to failure, they're on dialysis. And I'd never get into blaming them. My theory is, if you could quit smoking, you would. If you're feeling so bad, if your health is so bad that they're cutting your leg off you because, and smoking is contributing hugely to this, you're not choosing to be in that position. You just can't stop it. It's a habit. It's a horrible illness and you can't get out of it. So it's too late to be lecturing people at the age of 55, 60, 65. You need to be getting to them at schools. And that's what I mean earlier about Department of Education really needs to get their finger out. And we need to start teaching kids how to cook. Give them budgets. If food isn't at home, schools need to be given the budget to feed kids nutritious food at lunchtime.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how much that would cost the country. And I'm not the best at sums. Anyone listening to this will tell you that. But Like, the amount of money this country would save if we fed children properly all through primary and secondary school, because we're going to spend it on the other side when they come into hospitals 10, 20, 50 years time.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of money, that kind of education would be so well spent, they'd be better off, they'd be more nutritionally aware, they'd be able to cook for themselves, they'd be fitter mentally and physically, they'd probably go off to achieve much more, because some, like, you know yourself, a lot rides on where you're born.
Yeah.
And what your parents are like, if you even have both parents in the house, if you're lucky. And it depends on their skills, what they have, what they don't have. So you're already up against it if you're born in certain areas of the country or in certain households. And that's not fair. Mm-hmm. And I think a big way that we could help readdress the balance is by feeding children properly in schools.
Do you think it will help with all the issues that we're having HSE at the moment?
Yes, hugely. Yeah. Hugely. I mean, I've only dipped my toe in the water and people may say she doesn't know what she's talking about. And they might be right. But from what I can see, there are so many illnesses, both physical and mental, that comes from bad policy and stuff that we, that seeds that were or weren't planted as children.
Yeah, it's changing though.
Yeah.
Bit by bit.
It is. For people who can afford it or for people who know better, there's a huge section of society that just isn't. We're in a ticking time bomb. When you say you're changing,
I do see that too, though. Yeah, I do see that. Like, as in whenever I go to a school, it would have like a wellness week. And I wouldn't have had that. And then I go back to Mill Street and I wouldn't have a wellness week. They'd be like, oh, sure, what's that about?
Yeah. And then why are we having wellness week? It should just be wellness.
Yeah.
It should just be knit into it.
Yeah.
And I know that is changing, but this wellness week is too late for the 5 or 6 or 7 overweight children in the class who know they're overweight, but it's not their fault. You know, children that age don't have the money to be buying stuff, for example. That comes from home. It comes from the obesogenic environment we're living in. Like, we're surviving in an environment. I really hate when I hear people victim blaming for, oh, sure, it's her own fault, she's fat, she's eating all this kind of food. But like, when you actually step back and look into it, and I remember we had a few lectures in it and my mind was blown when I realised, like, we are living in a world, and I'm aware I'm saying this, but a beautiful muffin in front of me with loads of chocolate on that Joanne gave me. But like,
it's made from organic cacao powder.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
Organics. But like,
that's my relationship with food right there.
You know, it's like, we're bombarded with advertising about food. We're bombarded, and when we go to shops, the way things are laid out, they're there to encourage you to eat more, eat more, eat more. And then the life we're living in, we're sitting at desks all day, we're not moving. We've evolved very quickly to a sitting kind of race where we never really used to do that as people.
We're definitely more sedentary now.
Yeah, yeah. So we're sitting all the time, we're eating more than we ever ate. And then people are wondering why we have an obesity crisis, and we're blaming the people who are obese when really we should be looking at what can we do to prevent this or how can we help people. And we're not doing enough of that. And again, it's education.
Do you think it's because we don't have, and I don't mean to sound like weird or like nutritional or whatever like that, but it's because our relationship with food isn't right. Like, you know, we'll all buy, you know, meat and veg for dinner and then that's it. Like, we don't seem to change like Ireland.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I go home and it's the same stuff. It's potatoes. It's the meat. You know, it's like that's my dinner. You know what I mean? Like, do you think that's a generation thing again? Like, do you think that we're getting a little bit better with food?
I think we're getting a bit better. I think a bit like everything. I've actually been shooting a documentary with TG Carr over the summer that'll be going out in September, I think, or October, about what people used to do back in the day for cures and stuff and what we do now. And I think there was generally, once the 80s and 90s hit and people had money for the first time ever in this country, it was assumed that the old ways weren't good and the new ways are better. So stuff like breastfeeding went out the window and we brought in baby formula. Stuff like, you know, the food you grew at home went out the window and people began eating crispy pancakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mash came from a box. You know, packaged stuff was automatically seen as better and more superior. And then we suddenly realised, well, actually, maybe it's not. And we started kind of going back to our roots. Like, every house had a deep fat fryer back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be hard pressed now to find a house that has one in it. But again, that came from learning and understanding probably just not the best food to be eating all the time. We didn't know that. I think it definitely helps to be more adventurous with your food. I mean, I'm the worst person ever because the hours I keep, at times I decide I'd rather not be hungry. So sometimes I say, right, I haven't got the time to be eating my overnight oats and my lovely cocoa powder and my... So like sometimes I just boil up a pile of eggs and I'll take two with me and I'll peel them and I'll just wrap them in tissue paper and gnaw them in the car and wherever I'm going. And I know that sounds horrible and bland, but it means I have food in me, because otherwise...
That's what I mean with relationship. Like, do you find that we treat food as a necessity rather than something that has an impact on our life?
Yeah, we do.
Like, and we treat it as to keep us alive rather than...
I think if we did a bit more of that, sometimes we'd be doing well. I think a lot of the time, a lot of food, we tie a lot of emotions of food. Like, Christmas is seen as an excuse for gluttony. And that's fine for a dinner or a day, it can slip into a week, 2 weeks, and then you start feeling bad about yourself, and then it creates a vicious cycle. Whereas people. And then I think we also had a culture of eat your dinner, there's children starving in Africa.
Yeah.
But like the child be given a portion the same size as the adult, and then it becomes a war, and then all of a sudden you hate the food. You know, I just think we need to get a little bit more smart of learning how much food we actually need. And we also need, again, it comes all the way back to policy again, the way food is marketed needs to change. Like I remember somebody saying to me, there's no money in broccoli. Like there's a reason why, you know, big soft drink companies and alcohol companies and all these people are sponsoring mass produced programs and stuff, because advertising works. And unfortunately, Boards Bia ads ain't going to cut it against these people.
They're not sexy.
No.
It's not sexy seeing your farmer outside. It's sexy seeing someone sexy drink a Coke.
Exactly. But you know what? If a little bit of imagination went into it, I'm sure there's loads of sexy farmers out there who'd look great in ads. If you feel free to send in photos to me and Joanne, we'll send them off to Boards Bia.
Let's do it. Yeah, let's start our own campaign right here, right now. Journalism, are you planning on just, are you going to like filter it out eventually, or will you, you'll probably miss it. Like I get the impression you will miss it.
I'll miss aspects of it. Definitely. I was actually talking to Susan Keogh about this, about the day I eventually have to drop that mic for the last time, and I'll be really, really sad, because I've made great friends through media. I've had great relationships through it. It's opened up so many doors. Wonderful experiences. Like I've been to Syria with the Irish Army. I've done mad stuff. I've been to Windsor Castle. I've, you know, stuff that the normal person doesn't get to see. And that all came from media, and I love it. I can't see me being on sidelines when I'm an intern. I just can't see how it'd be possible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, also someone, I have to have a personal life every once in a while as well, you know, and that really gets kicked down the can. The can gets kicked down the road. I don't know. Do you know what? If you told me 2 years ago I'd be doing this, I'd say, yeah, right. So I'm loath to predict what I'll be doing in 2 or 3 years' time.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it'll be mad.
I guarantee you will be. It's something to do with the Meehan brothers.
God knows.
I don't know. And Supermax.
And Supermax. We might start a podcast from Supermax or something.
With the Meehan brothers as contributors.
The chats over snack boxes, and bring guests in as I'm having my snack box.
We could call it Chat Box.
Wow. Get on to Pat McDonough.
I'm on it. I'm on it. Chat right box. Now.
That, you know, who knows? I'm loath to say I'll never do it or I'll stop doing it. Look, the day may come, people may stop ringing me to ask me to do it, and that's fine too, you know, because... like I'm not as available as I should be to be doing this job, and I totally understand that people might say, look, we need somebody who's more available. But I'm loving what I'm doing with Off the Ball and stuff. I'm really enjoying it. Gerard Gilroy's been great. I've had great fun with him. He's been really supportive of what I'm doing. I'm sure he thinks I'm insane, but he's happy to let me off and do my thing. So I don't know. That's probably the best answer I can give you. I don't know what's around the corner, but I can guarantee you whatever it is, I'll be having the crack.
That's a nice way to end it though, I think. Like that's, I think we've had our hour together.
Have we had an hour?
Yeah, we've had the crack.
Can I eat my bun now so I don't be chewing on the microphone?
You can have your bun. And on that note, Mara's going to have her bun and we're going to sign off. Mara, thanks for coming.
Gormila Mahat.
Thanks very much for listening to my interview with Mara Trasny-Kallig, and thanks very much to Mara Trasser for giving up her time during the Munster final this year. Tune in next week where we interview Dr. Katie Liston, who is a Sociology of Sport professor in Ulster University, Jordanstown, where she talks about concussions, the sociological implications of men in sport, and what it's like to be a man in sport today, and all the stories surrounding concussion. Cheerio!
The Big Red Bench.
Game on!
Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.